You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
All the girls are complicated. Everyone is precious too, and you might get lucky if you do. Oh, you might get lucky if you do. Find the one that makes you laugh. Find the one that takes your breath, where you won't get everything that you want. Oh, but you'll need one to dote upon.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 199 of the Christian Feminist Podcast. I'm Christina Bieber Lake, and with me today is Victoria Reynolds Farmer and a person I just met for the first time, KB Moore. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Hi, Christina.
Well, you know, our protocol is just to start with introducing ourselves and what brought us into this particular program. So, KB, why don't you start?
Sure. My name is Kayla Beth Moore. I often go by KB. I'm based in Atlanta. I'm a writer. And I spend most of my time these days with a very sweet and very raucous toddler. But I am also an adjunct professor of English and an independent education consultant, which just means that I consult with families about the college application process. I came to this podcast through Victoria. Farmer, who's a dear friend. We're both based in Atlanta. This is my third episode with the Christian Feminist Podcast, and I'm really excited to be here. I always love these conversations so much.
And you love Flannery O'Connor, which makes
me... And I love Flannery O'Connor.
So happy. So how about you, Victoria?
Hi, everybody. I am Victoria Reynolds Farmer. I have a PhD in literature and gender and sexuality studies from Florida State. By day, I work for a market research firm in community engagement, and this podcast is my longest running hobby, I think, ever. We've been doing this for about 10 years now, which is crazy, and like KB said, I live in a suburb of Atlanta, and really excited to talk about Flannery O'Connor today, who I've always really loved for lots of reasons that I'm sure we will get into.
We will indeed. And I'm Christina Bieber Lake. I taught at Wheaton for 25 years. And just retired. I am now a professor of English emerita. I never thought that would happen. That's a long and crazy story that I won't go into, but I currently live in Texas. And I'm a Flannery O'Connor scholar. So this is exciting to be with my friends on the CFP talking about this great writer. So I think most of the people who are listening to this program probably know who Flannery O'Connor is, but in case you do not, I strongly urge you to go out and get some stories and begin reading. But she's a Georgia writer who was born in 1923, so we're coming up on a 100 years of anniversary of her birth, and I'm sure there are going to be all kinds of celebrations, next fall, September, for that. And she died at age 39 from complications due to lupus. And in the intervening years, which is 39 just seems younger and younger the older I get, she wrote some of the most amazing fiction from a Catholic perspective, Southern perspective, a unique perspective of any writer that I've ever encountered. And to me, she's the perfect choice for this show, because the reason why I was interested in studying her was that she was very smart, an artist, interested in art and interested in religion and interested in women's issues. And that was everything I was interested in. And so it was a no-brainer for me to pursue study with her. And I probably have mentioned in the past that I worked with Elizabeth Fox Genovese, and she was my advisor. And she was the first person I actually read Flannery O'Connor with. And so
I'm so jealous that you got to read O'Connor with her. I have been obsessed with her since I first started reading her work in graduate school. So that's so
Oh,
cool.
that yes, and I don't know if you knew that there's a collection of her sort of works that I worked on, about 5-volume collection a few years back, that you might be interested in taking a look at. So if you're ever in Texas, Victoria, you should, take a look at my volumes of that. It's some really interesting stuff. But anyway, so she was how I got first interested in Flannery O'Connor, although I did read her when I lived in Louisiana when I was teaching high school before I got my PhD at Emory. So I was in Flannery O'Connor land there, just not that far away from Milledgeville, so it made perfect sense for me to study her. So I want to hear from you all. I'm very interested, and since I've been teaching O'Connor classes for years, I'm always extremely interested in what students their first encounter with Flannery O'Connor, because she's famously really hard to understand. And so, meaning that people, they're like, what, she's a Catholic, kind of thing, because of all the dead bodies, basically. She has influenced all of these Southern grotesque and Gothic writers, the Coen brothers, these writers who write this kind of violent stuff, for lack of a better term. So students are, especially Protestant students, are pretty mystified. So if you guys could dig deep and tell our listeners what got you first interested in O'Connor, what were your first thoughts, if you can recover them? I'm very curious about that.
I could jump in. So, I guess the first time I encountered her would have been in a college class that I took on writing fiction. And the first two stories that I read, and I don't remember in which order they were, but it was Good Country People and A Good Man Is Hard to Find, which are often some of the most commonly assigned stories. And I just remember feeling like, what just happened? Like, whoa. And just flabbergasted. And I remember telling a friend who was in the class, she was like, have you done the reading this week? And I said, yes, read it in the daylight. Just
You
don't
said
read
that. You
it.
said read it in the
Yes.
daylight. I love it.
Yes. Don't read it in the dark alone. And I was mostly just flabbergasted, but also knew, I feel like I knew two things right away. One was this was an amazing craftsman. Just the form and the shape of this story was just pristine and so wonderfully carefully wrought. And the other thing was something of magnitude is happening that I don't fully understand
Yeah.
in all of these.
That's an
Now,
amazing way to put it. I love
yes,
that.
yeah. And are you a writer of fiction? You said you're a writer. Are you a writer of fiction?
I am mostly, my MFA is in poetry, but I do write fiction as well.
Okay. So you know how hard that is to produce both of those effects, both the craftsmanship and the
Yes.
feeling of magnitude. Yeah.
Yes. And it took me years. So just that feeling was like an itch in my brain for me, really. And I carried that into graduate school. And it's really, she's a big part of why I decided to pursue a master's of religion and literature at Yale. And when I got there, she was, anyway, kind of a longer story about how I felt like she was kind of came a companion to me in many ways. But the first, yeah, those are my first reactions.
It's so interesting. I always admire Flannery O'Connor's own saying about short stories. A story is not really a story unless it hangs on and expands in the mind after you finish it. And she does that brilliantly. Victoria, what were your thoughts?
So, as a disabled native Georgian Catholic, like
Yeah, where are my thoughts?
I feel like I Flannery O'Connor has, in a certain way, always been inside my bones. I find her work, both her fiction and like her letters, and actually especially her prayer journal, which I read for the first time last night, and contains maybe the most relatable sentence I have ever read and thought about, which we'll get to eventually. I don't know. I grew up about an hour and a half outside of Milledgeville, so Andalusia is
Oh, I
a
don't think I knew that.
yes.
That's where you grew up?
I went to elementary school in Dublin, Georgia, which is fairly
Oh, no.
close.
Dublin all the time, Georgia? That's from James Joyce, Dublin all the time? Oh, my gosh. I did not know that. How could I have known you all these years and not known you were from Dublin, Georgia?
I have other stories about that for another time, but yes, we went to Andalusia on field trips growing up. So I like knew about it and knew O'Connor.
At that time, it wasn't open to the public.
Oh, really? Was it not?
When you were growing up, it was privately owned, so
Oh,
you had to
okay.
get permission to go there. Maybe you were a
Yes.
part of groups, yeah.
So that would have been probably the mid-90s, I guess.
Okay, all right. That was when I was in grad school. Just a reminder of how much older I am than you.
I'm sorry. I
That's
love
when I
you.
went there.
Thank you for being my friend.
Oh man, sometimes I just forget. I just forgot.
Yeah, so because that would have been, sorry again, Christina, like 4th or 5th grade. So yeah, mid-90s-ish. So I knew that, like I just knew about her work. I didn't really start reading the stories until high school. My high school English, or my, I guess it would have been, no, middle school. So that would have been like 7th or 8th grade. Sally Grover, my middle school English teacher, who I've talked about at great length on this podcast, who I dedicated my master's thesis to, she took pity on me and the fact that I didn't really have a lot of friends. We weren't allowed to stay in the school building for mid-morning snack break at our school, but she essentially let me hide out in her classroom and we would talk about books and
I love that.
she would tell me to read things. I know, and like it was such a saving grace to me as an awkward 14-year-old, and now as someone on the other side who has taught, I thought that woman sacrificed the 15 minutes of her day where she did not have to be around kids to me and my awkwardness. Like, God bless her forever. She
You know
gave
what? We all have stories like that, right? Of the teacher who saw us and sacrificed something for us. Yeah.
So that's the first time I really read O'Connor's stories. She gave me Everything That Rises Must Converge, and she gave me A Good Man Is Hard to Find. She, perhaps on purpose, did not give me Good Country People, which I did not read until after I was married and got so like emotional that I did start crying and I almost threw up because I was just
Wow.
so like I just so couldn't handle all of the
Wow.
things it made me feel. And we can talk about that when we get to the story. But
Yeah,
I feel
we
like
are going to get to it.
I didn't really start to love O'Connor until I started to teach her in graduate school when I started teaching intro literature classes, and then later in Minnesota. When I, was an adjunct, but it was so great teaching her in Georgia and Florida because there's a certain amount you don't have to tell your students because
Oh yeah,
they
'cause they know
just,
the grandmother in
right,
a
they're
good man
like,
is hard to find. Yeah, exactly.
that's my
Yeah.
grandma, and like these are the
Yep.
people of my small southern
Yep.
town.
They know them.
So I loved that. Anyway, I'll stop talking.
No, it's I mean
Can
I had to
I?
overcome the fact of Midwesterners all the time. Yeah. Go ahead. Okay, KB.
Yeah, well, on that topic of like when you're in the South, they're sort of her characters are a known entity. So when I went to Yale, and in my first semester there, it was a religion. I think the class was like religious themes in contemporary fiction, modern and contemporary fiction. We read a lot of O'Connor, and I was like one of only two Southerners in the room.
Oh,
and
wow.
Our dear professor,
who was
I will
your
not
professor?
Name.
Oh, you're not going to name. Okay.
because this is sort of an unflattering story about him, but he would ask me to read it aloud, to like read sections aloud, to like make this, to quote, make the story come to life.
Because you had an accent?
Because I had an accent, and, you know, just disregard the fact that I have an Appalachian accent and not a Deep South accent.
Yeah.
Those are very different.
Yes, they are.
But it was the closest thing that people could come by. And it got really terribly awkward one day where, and I sort of, you know, I was 23, I was new, I was intimidated and also sort of honored that I was being asked to read, or like was getting the professor's attention, I guess. But it got to the point where I was being asked every class period to read some of the like incredibly racist dialogue.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I at one point just had, I like stopped mid-sentence.
Yeah.
And said, I can't anymore. And it became sort of a touchstone of that class for me. But it also, and years later, I was back at on campus and saw that professor, and he came to me and apologized.
He did.
For putting me in that position, and I really appreciated it. And we sort of made amends and have from then on stayed in touch. But it was, you know, O'Connor, that was just one moment where I was like, she became so precious to me for many reasons. One was that I was this Southerner who had gone north with these literary ambitions, you know, and
yes.
I felt like I started reading her letters at that time. And it was very clear that she had been in these situations where nobody gets it. Nobody gets the racism, or no, but people outside of the South sort of don't understand the same, the reality of the kinds of racism that she knew so well.
Right. And they don't
yeah.
understand that
yeah.
there are nuances to it.
Yes.
And that
yes.
there are,
yes.
like, my students in Minnesota would complain and say, like, you know, it's so racist down there. And I would say, how many of you live in North Minneapolis?
Yeah.
And, you know, like it's, or, you know, talk to me about the racial makeup of the South Side of Chicago. Like it's, you know.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's completely different. And the integration in the South may have been government forced. And of course, there's a lot of problems with that and Jim Crow and, you know, lots
mm-hmm.
of things. But like it's much more nuanced than down there they're racist and up here we're not. And
oh yeah,
yeah.
Not to mention that her favorite targets were people like Julian in Everything Rises Must
yes.
Converge,
and
who
that,
is
that's
above
why I
all.
Love teaching that in my freshman classes. Yeah,
yeah, that is a perfect
exactly.
story to teach for that,
because I had so many students who went into the story thinking the joke was on Julian's mother. And then when you get to the point of the story where you realize that the joke is in fact on Julian, it was always a really interesting story to teach.
You know, I was just
totally.
At Belmont Abbey, and the there's a group of performers who did that play there. It was a conference on Southern Catholicism, and I had not seen that performed before. Karen Coonrod is the director. It was fantastic.
Wow.
I wish that I could just have teleported all of my friends to see that, because it was so powerful. Yeah. Anyway. All right. Well, let's talk about Good Country People. And I chose this story because, as I said, it's my favorite one. And I knew that we would all resonate with it. And I am very curious about, I don't know, the older I get and the more just sort of as a moving beyond the academy and trying to write for real people, what makes people change their minds about anything? Why do stories work so more powerfully? How do they reach our imaginations? I'm interested in all of these questions. you know, how does this story work? What do you like about it? Why is it a story that's worth reading and rereading?
Well, I love this story because I hate it is how I'm going to
Fair
start
point.
Off. Like,
yeah.
I relate very deeply to Joy Holga. I relate to feeling like so she's leaving her small southern town to be an academic. She's trying to figure out what the life of the mind is. And even before you get to the disability stuff, which is deeply, deeply affecting for me in the way I take this story into my body. But even before you get into that, like her relationship with her mother and with, who's the other woman? The woman with the two idiot daughters. What's her name?
Hopewell.
Mrs. Hopewell and Mrs. Why can't I come up with the name?
Freeman. Yeah, so the way she kind of thinks about them and her particular, well, I'll just say it because I feel like O'Connor would, her particular, the sins that she is particularly given to, I relate to. This kind of haughtiness and her desire to be the smartest person in the room and put people down and kind of have intellectual control of situations. The pride wrapped up in all of that, I relate very deeply to. Even before, you know, we talk about the disability stuff. So that's the thing that I kind of affects me is I feel like I understand where she's coming from as a person and the particular problems that she has.
Yeah, and obviously this is so much of a, I like to call it a cautionary tale for herself, what she herself would be if it wasn't for the church, Flannery O'Connor. You know, mm-hmm. she would be this kind of haughty, prideful, you know, mm-hmm. woman in the South. And I think that's why she writes her so well. And she also said it's the easiest thing that she's ever written. It just kind of came out, you know, of her pen.
Wow.
So, you know, not to mention the fact that O'Connor was, you know, raised in a very, a place that did not understand her. Right. So the temptation
right.
is always going to be to stomping around and recreating yourself and naming yourself Holga or whatever when you've been given this beautiful name. So there's just all these things. KB.
Yeah. I resonate a lot with what Victoria says. It's just a story where no one is safe. And that's what that's what I always feel when I read O'Connor is no one is safe. No one is even when you, especially when you feel that you have the world figured out.
Yes.
So any character who sort of has a worldview that is tidy, look out.
Yeah.
And of course we all seek that. Right. And so one of the things I find particularly disturbing is, LOL Manly Pointer.
Oh
my goodness.
Just like, come on, like if you were her friend and she sent you that manuscript, wouldn't you be like, you have to change his name?
No.
No, I mean, I love that choice, and here's why. So I mean, I'd never loved explaining that choice to students, of course, but
right.
but I love that choice because all of the other names in the story are like straight out of a medieval morality play, like
True.
Hopewell, Freeman, Joy, like all of these are very,
yes.
They look like names out of Everyman, right? And
yeah.
So, so into that kind of backdrop walks a person who's, name is like basically penis and like and I think that's the most Flannery O'Connor thing in the world, and I love it.
I love it too.
Well, the thing that is like so disappointing about or just like disturbing to me when I read the story, but again, it's like how does she do this? She repels and magnetizes. Like, these characters are both like so repulsive and magnetic at the same time. It's like,
that's the grotesque. That is the definition of the grotesque right there.
Wow. But he uses everything. So Joy Holga is brought up in this super religious world, right? And he's a Bible salesman, which to her is like, she sees as a sort of caricature or something. But it's also what a part of her trusts.
Yeah. And, oh, yeah. She doesn't realize that she has bought into the whole idea of good country people, that they should exist, in fact.
Yes. And so it's so disturbing to see a character, to see a story where a person is able to take exactly what you are taught to trust and use it against you.
Yeah, because it's a, you know, it's like so many of her stories, a double critique. It's a critique of Joy, and it's a critique of her mother and the whole worldview that Joy thinks she's above but is actually buying into. And then even as it is a critique of the whole idea of good country people, it insists that the value of relationships that Joy actually has is the highest and best value.
Right.
It's an extraordinary move that I can't, it's just so difficult to accomplish that, to make you realize that she starts to, the scene where she's with him in the, you know, the loft, and she's actually losing control, right? She's actually falling for this guy. She thinks she's going to be in control and seduce him. And it's the language of marriage. She sees him in her imagination, right? Like taking her artificial leg off every night and then putting it back on.
Yeah.
And what I find so remarkable about this story is that Joy kind of knows that this is what she actually wants, you know, is that kind of trust. And I don't know about you guys, but I've taught this story so many times. The thing that blows me away about it is, and I try to explain this to the students, is that this scene is more intimate than a sex scene with the leg.
It's so intimate. And like, I can feel myself get like my chest is getting hot just thinking about that scene in the loft, because it's so intimate. I so completely relate as someone who has worked her entire life to kind of create this intellectual wall that compensates for physical difficulties. Like, it's just so, it's so deeply relatable, and I've been in situations in I've been on dates and in public places where people have uncharitable views of disabilities. I may have said this on this podcast before, but the worst blind date I ever went on turned out to be a date with a disability fetishist, and that is the only time I ever said I was going to the bathroom and then made it out of the back door of the restaurant. And,
wow.
And
I'm glad you did.
Yes, thank you. So every time I read this story, I think about things like that, and I think about the fact that women with disabilities are twice as likely to be sexually abused as able-bodied women. And like all of these things, and like this is the one moment where she lets herself be emotionally vulnerable, and that happens, and then she physically can't leave. And it's so awful. But the fact that it's so awful is what makes it such an amazing story.
It's truly incredible. And even if you're not coming from a position of disability, coming from a position of being a woman, an intellectual woman, whose power is not her body to attract men, right, but her mind, and the temptation to live in that space, right, and think that you're above it all, but really deep down wanting a man, you know, to treat you like not a brain on a stick, right?
Yeah.
That's truly what she wants, right? She wants somebody who loves her for who she is, body and mind, you know, in her disability and her weakness, and, you know, and she gives herself over to that. And of course it's the wrong person, right?
Totally.
I just find that an unbelievable, just the and thinking about Flannery O'Connor, she was awkward, right? That's the one thing that I thought Wildcat, the film, got exactly right, is how awkward she would have been in a cocktail party.
Definitely.
This is not her way of like moving through the world, right? She lives inside of her mind in so many ways, and just that awkwardness, and you're not the typical, especially not typical Southern female, you know. What do you think about that, KB? Like, I just feel like it's more than just like, I mean, it's all of those things, right? It's all at once. It's a critique of all of those things. And I find that amazing.
It is. Yeah. So just so many, I love that in this story in particular, we have the foils of the, what are their names? Glynis and, I wish she calls them.
Glynis and Karame.
Glynis and Karame. Like these paramours of Southern gentility. There are so many, I'm curious, this is kind of maybe getting ahead, but in the Wildcat film, the decision to cast Maya Hawke in so many of those roles in the story, I was kind of moved by that, just as a move to sort of gesture that there are so many of these characters who we can, you know, whether it's a logical fallacy or a reading error or whatever, that we can see O'Connor in, and therefore often see our own selves, and who are these intellectual people in the South who don't fit in, and that gives them a tendency to feel higher and mightier. And she's so clued in to what a liability that is, what a spiritual, moral liability that is.
Yes, and particularly a spiritual liability, right? Because it is the thing that's going to keep you from thinking that you need somebody else, because she, you know, like in a relationship, but also just God. You know, she just completely doesn't believe that she needs anybody. I've seen through to nothing, you know. There's nothing there. Right. I don't need anything. You know, this whole thing is a farce. And turns out, no, you actually do need people, you know.
Yes, and that when Manly Pointer shows up, or before he leaves, he's like, I've been believing in nothing my whole life. Like, you don't have – this is not a new idea.
Yeah, this is not a new idea. And let me tell you what it looks like. It looks like this. I'm going to abuse you.
It looks like actual evil.
Yeah, I'm gonna hurt you. I'm gonna take something from you. I'm gonna consume you and spit you out.
And
you know?
Enjoy it. And enjoy it. I'm gonna do all of those things and feel good about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And she really comes, you know, face to face with what that believing like nothing looks like. And you find out she doesn't really believe in nothing. And
right. Yes. And so it's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. But, you know, unlike a lot of her other stories, Flannery O'Connor leaves her up in the attic, the loft, I mean, to think about it rather than shooting her off immediately or goring her with a bull. So there's at least a possibility. You know, Flannery O'Connor famously didn't want to tell the rest of the story because it would verge too much on sentimentality, right? She was most afraid of sentimentality. The cheap kind of emotion. And so she's not going to give you the satisfaction of seeing what Joy might, how she might recover herself as Joy. She's just going to leave her there and you up in the loft thinking about it. So,
right.
And I actually love that about that story.
It gets me to
go ahead.
Well, it makes me think about something that I always wonder with O'Connor is, you know, she talk so often in the essays about violent grace, right? Or these sort of moments of violence that open up a possibility for grace. And as a reader, I'm always wondering, like, am I experiencing that? You know, where is that? If I didn't know that that was her purpose, would I experience that? Would I feel that?
Yeah, that's the question that why I asked what I asked at the beginning. You know, when you first read her, how did you read her?
Yeah.
because it is not the first thing that we will typically do when something like that happens, right?
Exactly. And I think coming from at least a Protestant perspective or a modern perspective or whatever middle class, whatever perspective, that I don't associate violence with grace in my life, you know? And so when I read her, I think that's part of what's so jarring is like I said, it's very clear to me that something big, something of magnitude is happening. But the ability to put one's finger on it isn't.
And that she felt very strongly that because this is the way that I read it anyway, our illusory framework, self-delusionary frameworks are so strong, right, that it takes something very powerful to crack them. You know, and a good man is hard to find. I used to be able to teach it better by referring to Fight Club when that movie was all the rage, you know, because it's like, you know, you have a gun in your face and it clarifies things for you. She'd have been a good woman if there was somebody to shoot her every minute of her life, because you're just like, no, what do I really think here? You know, and all the illusory, the delusions just fall away. And she felt that it takes that sometimes. And I, you know, you can agree or disagree with it, you know, and I think that makes for a very interesting scholarly conversation.
Totally. Yeah.
What do you think, Victoria? Do you find that view of violence or violence breaking in as a kind of grace affecting or disaffecting?
I like it. But I also think that it's very Catholic. Like,
yes, I agree.
In terms of like the embodied sacraments, for example, I'm a discussion leader at our church's RCIA, Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults. So it's the classes you take when you are converting to Catholicism. And I went through those classes myself about 4 years ago. And now I'm a discussion leader for people who are converting. And I think 2 or 3 weeks ago, we talked about the Eucharist. And because that's always one of our early classes, because that's something that people coming from Protestantism tend to kind of stick on and not really understand, is the doctrine of transubstantiation and the Catholic view of the Eucharist. And I quoted Flannery O'Connor to my table when we were talking about the Eucharist, and they show this scene that I'm about to mention in Wildcat, though the person who says this thing that sets O'Connor off is different in the film. What actually happens is that Mary McCarthy, the author, is talking about taking communion in church growing up, and she what a beautiful symbol she thinks it is, and O'Connor says, if it's a symbol, then to hell with it. And I agree with that. I think that, like, you need the violence, the embodiment. You need the fact that you are ingesting the literal flesh and blood of Christ to really fully understand the miracle and the theological import. I that is my own theological belief. I'm not saying everybody should agree with me, and I'm not saying everybody should be Catholic, though that would make me happy, honestly.
Yes, but you can be an Anglican. You can be an Anglican, for instance, and believe everything you just said perfectly well. In fact, I agree with you 100%, and I even wrote a book called The Incarnational Art of Flannery O'Connor.
Right.
The basic thesis is exactly that.
I was hoping you would mention that book, which is wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, but like the modern religion is Gnostic. It's separating the mind from the body and believing that what you do in the mind and think about in the mind is more important than what happens in the body. And Flannery O'Connor completely slaps that in the face with all of the stories, you know, drags you through the body because the body is how you know things. And that's, she gets this from Aquinas, you know, that the mode of the knower isn't the knowing is in the mode of the knower, meaning that you can't know angelically. Human beings don't know angelically. We know through the incarnated flesh of Jesus.
Right. Absolutely.
And so the sacraments are just a picture of that. And I think she does it so brilliantly that it's just hard to, it's hard to explain to students who don't really kind of understand how deeply unsacramental most Protestant kind of convictions tend to be, how wordy they are, how wordy Protestantism is. So I feel like I spend the first time when I teach a class on Flannery O'Connor just trying to get them to explain why Emerson is not a good model for us for spirituality, you know, but how deep it gets into our thinking, even in our faith, how the modern is more Manichaean than he realizes. Flannery O'Connor would put it that way.
The last time I went to see family in Savannah, which is another place O'Connor lived, and it's where I was born and where my parents grew up. But the last time I went to see family there, Michael and I got to go to Mass in O'Connor's parish, and I kept thinking, like, you know, O'Connor genuflected at this altar, and like O'Connor probably sat in one of these pews, and it was just like, it was really beautiful.
That's so great. Yeah, and that's also Southern lit. Let me just be, you know, I studied Southern lit as well, and so much of it is this kind of genius for understanding that the abstract is something to distrust and the concrete is something that really links you to reality, so that your limitations are a gateway to reality because they keep you from this abstraction, you know, this kind of pie in the sky thinking that is not grounded in reality. And I would agree that Southern literature is all about that in some ways. So that's pretty good. In other words, it's a sense of place really permeates the work. But okay, I'm like rambling now. So let's talk about Wildcat. I'm very interested in your thoughts about this film. Most satisfying, least satisfying, wherever you want to go with it. And unless you want to say more about Good Country People, I'm not trying to like be a boss, but what do you think?
I think we can talk about the movie. I liked a lot of it. I really like what you said, KB, about the power of casting O'Connor in her own stories. Maya Hawke, who is lovely and whose other work I have really liked. She's amazing on Stranger Things. She plays.
Yes, she is.
She plays O'Connor. But she also, there are scenes kind of interspersed with the regular biopic stuff, her going to the Iowa Writers' Workshop and her back home in Milledgeville and her deciding to buy peacocks and all of these sort of O'Connor signpost things that anybody would know are interspersed with scenes from the stories where O'Connor herself is kind of embodying one of the characters. And I really liked that a lot for the reasons that you mentioned. I think when a lot of us read these stories, we picture ourselves in them, and we've all said how we kind of relate to O'Connor and her characters and their particular foibles and sins and all of those things. So I thought that was a really good choice. I wasn't sure, and maybe Christina, maybe you can help here. The thing that Michael and I talked about a lot after we watched the movie was, who is this for? Like, is this for someone who doesn't know anything about O'Connor, or is this for someone who knows a lot about O'Connor? Because I think both groups of people would kind of find a lot of holes in it. And so that was the thing that I wasn't sure about, even though there was a lot to like about the movie. Though I will tell you that the thing that made me the most upset was somebody should have taught her how to walk with crutches, and they did not. And why was there not like some sort of disability consultant involved? I was like, she is not putting her weight in the right place, and she would not. Anyway, it's fine.
Well, and it's, you know, anybody who has experience with the particular thing, like there's been a lot of fussing about her accent, about Maya Hawke's accent.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that goes without saying. Like, all Southern accents in film that are not done by actual Southern people are basically an act of aggression. And, like, I hate them all. I just, that goes without saying.
Yeah. And it's too bad, because with a little extra work, they certainly could have gotten the walking on the crutches correct. And with a little extra work, you know, maybe helped with the accent piece, you know. But I understand there's limited time, limited resources, and so on. But let's return to that question, Victoria, because I think it's a very good one. Who the film is for? One could even ask, who are, you know, biopics for in general, but in particular this one. I mean, I know that Ethan Hawke definitely has been like a closet Episcopalian for 20 years and admires O'Connor. I know that Maya Hawke did her audition with part of the Prayer Journal for this thing that she was in. It was another biopic by Shelby Gaines and Ethan Hawke, who are the writers of this one. And the name of it is escaping me at the moment, but it's amazing. It's about a musician, so another artist figure, which of course is interesting to smart actors like Ethan Hawke, you know, who's a writer.
Right.
So who is this for? Who do you think it's for?
My husband and I watched it together. He teaches American literature. He teaches O'Connor. And we both were like, it felt like insider baseball a little bit. Like we both super enjoyed it. We both, loved kind of waiting, seeing who could guess which short story, we were in first, you know. But I don't know, and I just can't occupy that headspace, but I don't know if it would be as interesting or compelling to a person who isn't super familiar with her, especially because of the form of the movie is very strange. As Victoria mentioned, you know, it's biopic with like six small adaptations. Interspersed, which I loved, but I don't know that without the sort of traditional narrative arc that just a pedestrian off the street or someone, you know, if my neighbor would find it.
Yeah, if you didn't
compelling.
Know the story, would you get enough of the story? I mean, I think it works, for instance, with Everything That Rises Must Converge, because that moment, the sort of climax of that, you know, where she has the stroke, it doesn't have to be translated into the larger context of the story as much.
Right.
I'm kind of thinking aloud here, but I remember when I was sitting in the theater watching this, I was like, I could see people getting that. And I could see people getting what I thought was the most hilarious moment and was in Revelation when they had the white Jesus.
Absolutely. Totally.
Yeah. That was great.
You know, and so you don't have to be an expert in her stories or have read them at all to get those two scenes. But I'm less sure with things like the Good Country People scene. So,
yeah. And I think too, and maybe you can relate to her, to Flannery O'Connor. It's so funny because it's like, it's almost like we're in Inferno. We've got Dante poet, Dante pilgrim. We've got like Flannery writer, Flannery character in some of these. Maybe you could relate to Flannery, the writer in the film, as, you know, just a person with creative inclinations or ambitions. I do think that one thing that they did super well is they captured the sort of spiritual struggle of her life, which comes through so deeply in the Prayer Journal, which is, I am a person of deep faith and I have these creative ambitions and those things feel at odds. And that's a real problem.
You know, that's interesting, because I in the review that I wrote of the film, that was the one problem that I had with it, was that they made it sound like it was a bigger conflict for her than I have ever read it to be.
Interesting.
The thing that bothered me about the way they incorporated the prayer journals, and like maybe this is just a film as medium problem. And the thing that made me ask that "who is this for" question is I felt like the film was degraded at least somewhat by just turning the prayer journals into spoken dialogue, and
yeah,
I don't know how you're supposed to do that in a different way in a movie, but I felt like there wasn't that the prayer journals are so human and nuanced and deep and interesting that just inserting them into the film that way alongside inserting her into the short stories just felt like disrespectful is too strong a word, but like too easy, not nuanced enough.
Yeah, you know, and as somebody who's really read those letters, it's not just from the prayer journal, but they take stuff from letters and essays, you know, which makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. And I know them so well that I mean, I could quote them from memory so well, right? I mean, 30 years of studying O'Connor, right? So that I knew that the moment where Joy Holga is crossing over, you know, or I can't remember the scene where it's talking about with gritting teeth and stalking Joy, I know that line. I know what letter it's from, and I know what she meant by it. And it wasn't this kind of, oh, well, I guess I'm stuck in Georgia. That was not what that is mm-hmm. about. And it made the – I mean, I understand the desire to focus on one moment in O'Connor's life when she's a young woman and she finds out she has lupus, right? Like, that makes perfect sense to me. But they simplify it to this big, almost like debate that she had with her faith because of the lupus, and I don't see that in her at all.
Yeah, I didn't like that either, and I also thought that, like, because of all the things we've already said about Catholicism and embodiment and physicality, I felt like this thing is wrong with my physical body, and that affects my faith. That is, in addition to being kind of Protestant in thought, is also like kind of ableist as a perspective.
Oh,
like,
it totally
I, like,
is.
I don't think
that's not,
I mean,
the way she thought of it at all.
Right. And I don't want to like project myself and my thoughts about my own body onto O'Connor and her thoughts about her body too much. But I have read the letters, and I know enough to know, like, that's not really her relationship with her kind of imago Dei body either.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, and I think the moment that epitomized that is these problems for me is the scene where the priest, Liam Neeson, comes
Liam
in.
Neeson,
who question I love, mark right? as her priest. Oh, I was like, is that so Liam Neeson?
Well,
and it was.
That comes from a story that is about Asbury, the Enduring Chill, that Flannery O'Connor is not Asbury.
Yeah, right.
Like she's Joy, yeah. Like she's, you know, these other,
yeah.
Or tempted to be at all. She was never tempted to be somebody like Asbury.
Yeah.
In the Enduring Chill. I'm sorry, KB, I totally cut you off.
Interesting. So was that's the Enduring Chill, or that was Flannery
it's
writer?
It's a mixing of the two, okay?
Weird, so, okay.
The movie is making it
both,
right?
Yeah, the movie is making
it
both.
Okay, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, so Liam Neeson plays Father Flynn, I think is the name, and Father Flynn's in a story about Julian, but Flannery O'Connor's playing herself in the bed talking to him in
the same
place.
Okay, because she also has lines from the journal.
Go ahead, sorry.
She also has lines from the journal in that moment. Isn't that where she says, like, I'm a cheat? No, maybe it's the scene after that where she says, I'm a cheese. Or make me a mistake now, I'm a cheese or something. You know what I'm talking about?
But it mixes up a lot of different things. It's definitely not right out of The Enduring Chill, and it's definitely not just right out of the prayer journal. It's all of those things kind of mashed together. But it's clearly suggestive of the story, The Enduring Chill, and that was not one of those stories that Flannery O'Connor had as a cautionary tale to herself. That was a takedown of the Asbury's of the writing world who think they know better than their mothers, about embodied life on the farm and about how to have communion with the the black workers, you know, all of which he completely fails at because he has no accurate self-conception. That was not Flannery O'Connor's struggle. It made it sound like, well, now I've got to be back here on the farm with mom and blah, blah, blah. You know, no, I thought that, and I'm sorry, but I'm just get so passionate about this because when those guys asked me as a Flannery O'Connor scholar what I most wanted to see in the film, what I said was the joy and the giving that she was for other people, you know, out of her love, that she was joyful. I felt like there was so little joy in this film.
Yeah.
And that scene was one of the places where it was like, it made it seem like it's like, well, oh, well, I'm stuck here with these, you know, backwater folks like my mom. You know, she ribbed her mom a lot, but it was good hearted ribbing.
Yeah.
And you don't get to see much of that. I don't know, Victoria, we haven't had a chance to talk about this. We texted about it a little bit, but did you feel like Flannery O'Connor as a person would have been like the way that Maya was?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know that it's Maya's fault. I feel like it's the...
No, right. I don't mean that at all. I don't think it's an acting problem.
Right.
I think it's a problem.
Yeah, I feel like the writing is most to blame here. I don't know. There were a lot of things I liked about the movie, but like I said, there's not enough straight biopic stuff for it to be a biopic for people who know nothing about O'Connor. And if it is supposed to be inside baseball-y, so much of that is wrong, too. The timeline is wonky. There's way too much Robert Lowell, goodness gracious.
Yeah, they're trying to make it sound like she was in love with him, which is just not true.
That's not, that relationship was much more complicated than that. The timeline is wrong. Like, he wouldn't have been her lecturer at Iowa. Parker's back is in the wrong place, like, chronologically. So, like,
I actually liked that.
I loved the choice in terms of storytelling. But, like, if you want this to be a wonky inside baseball thing, why did you jack up the timeline?
Correct.
I don't know. I keep going back and forth about this movie. And I was excited about it when I heard about it, not just because you were involved, which is, you know, good on them for asking you because you are an expert and they should. But I am the kind and age of English major that I have had a crush on Ethan Hawke since I was like 14. You know, Reality
Look,
Bites.
I remember, you know, what's the poets, Dead Poets Society. Okay.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
I was young enough to be like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I watched that when I was a kid too, but like between Reality Bites and Hamlet and freshman year of college watching Before Sunrise and drinking wine coolers or whatever whatever,
a really funny image, Victoria.
Yeah,
I just gotta say,
whatever nonsense that was. Anyway, yeah, I was really excited about this movie for all of those reasons, and I did enjoy a lot of it, but a lot of it just kind of stuck in my craw too.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun, and I think that it was interesting. I think I feel like I was able to sort of accept in good faith, like, they have made a weird movie about a weird person.
That's a really
and
good point.
I felt like there was something about the form that honored her work that it
I
was.
I totally agree with that.
Disjointed and strange, yeah. and she did have. I mean, she was. There was a lot of lonely. I appreciate what you're saying, Christina. That she brought. She had tremendous friendships. And so much of the letters are, you know, are so vibrant with that. And she was such a devoted correspondent, and she did bring people so much joy. But it does, and I don't think it's me projecting to say there was loneliness in
I hear you.
In her vogue, especially as regards her vocation. Her vocation.
Yeah, yeah.
And right. I think the film got that.
Yeah. No, I think that's an excellent point. And I will take that in. And especially forgetting what it must have been like at that young age of just discovering the diagnosis. And like I said, I love the focus on that because that had to be just unbelievable. You know, here she was like ready to, you know, she was in Iowa, she went to Yaddo, she went to New York City, didn't want to stay there, let me be perfectly clear, but was going places, you know, and to have that had to be rough. And I appreciate the loneliness of that. So that's an excellent point. Let's talk about the prayer journal now, because this is a good place to put it in, because the prayer journal, you get a sense of that, her calling, her vocation, the loneliness inside of that, but also the real spiritual issues, you know, with being wanting to be the best writer that she could be, wanting to be a great writer for God, and in ways that it struggles with faith, but in ways it doesn't. I find just such an interesting text. So what do you guys like about the prayer journal?
I was so conflicted when it came out because I was like, I don't know that this should have been published. I'm curious if either of you felt like that, because I'm glad that we have it. And I know there's precedent for publishing such things, but it just felt so intimate.
That's interesting. That's really interesting, because as a Flannery O'Connor scholar, my relationship to a piece of thing like this is totally different. Right.
Sure.
In the sense, you're just like, I'd heard about this when I was at Emory in the mid-90s studying Flannery O'Connor in grad school. And I talked to Sally Fitzgerald and I said, I've heard that you got a prayer journal, you know, somewhere that, you know, that she kept when she was younger. And I would really like to see that. She goes, I bet you would like to get your hands on that, wouldn't you?
Oh, my gosh. What a story.
And I felt like a dirty scholar, like I felt like a dirty voyeur, you know, but what you're saying is really the more accurate thing to say, which is to say this is a very intimate piece of writing. And is it necessarily that needs to be out there?
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, this was a question. It's a kind of an irrelevant question now because we have it. And I, you know, I'm able to really appreciate it. It does. I really find it. There's so much in it that I find so poignant, and moments that remind me of like George Herbert and others who've struggled with these artistic vocations in relation to their faith. And there's so much of it that I love. It's hard to articulate exactly what about it is so moving, other than it's just so honest and raw about the desires of her heart and this vocation that, like, she knows so clearly that her vocation is a gift and also a curse, and that it's, in order to fully pursue it, she's going to have to let go of other things. But she also knows that Christ is supposed to be first and foremost in her heart. She also knows that if she does this well, that it could be to God's service. But she still is, like, ambitious, you know, and I think that she struggles with this.
You know, it's so interesting because she has known, and this makes it clear from such an early age, that she was meant to be an artist, that this was a gift. The vocation was not something she invented, right? And she's very clear about that, and I think has her head on straight about it. But it's like she knew she was going to die, and she knew that this was her calling. I mean, I'm talking about later, like after she gets the lupus, and she had copies of all the letters, right? This was the 50s and 60s that were kept, right, on purpose. They did not have to be recovered, right? They were. So you have to think that she knew that this could be published. And I'm just trying to think, if I was, you know, I was 38 and I was, approaching 39, I was on my deathbed, and I was pretty well-established writer, would I take the journals that I have some 25 volumes of and destroy them?
Yeah.
I would. Lord, thank the Lord in heaven that my teenage and early 20s prayer journals are in a dumpster somewhere, and like, and I'm not even famous. I am 38 going on 39 this year, so that has been hitting pretty hard, as we've been talking about that. I did have some thoughts as I was reading this. So I knew that this prayer journal existed, though I did not read it until last night. I read the whole thing in one sitting and then like read it halfway through again, because this was a revelation to me. I was so deeply touched by it. And this is going to sound selfish and ridiculous, and like maybe I need to confess it this weekend. I don't know. I'll keep thinking about that when I examine my conscience later. But I am so comforted by the fact that Flannery O'Connor and I struggle with the same sins. Like, is it weird that that is incredibly comforting to me?
No, it's comforting to me too. I think that's what drew us all to her.
Like, I know it doesn't mean that my sins are less sinful, but I do, like, I'm going to read the passage that stuck with me the most, which is on page 19 in my copy. All this is about charity. Dear Lord, please make my mind vigilant about that. I say many, many too many uncharitable things about people every day. I say them because they make me look clever. Please help me to realize practically how cheap this is. I have nothing to be proud of yet myself. I am stupid, quite as stupid as the people I ridicule. Please help me to stop this selfishness because I love you, dear God. I don't want to be all excuses, though. I am not much. Please help me to do your word, O Lord.
Great choice.
I felt that like so deep in my chest. I kept thinking about my favorite priest, my favorite confessor, who is sadly no longer at my parish. But he said to me several times after confession, it seems that most of your sins are sins of speech. And what do you think that means?
And he said that to you?
To me. Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's something I've been thinking about a lot. And to think that O'Connor may have also, if she was right about herself here, heard that from a confessor made me feel not better, because sin is still sin, but at least less alone in it. Like I have a lot of comfort in that.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I know you know this, but just saying it, that your sins, your weaknesses, right, are always the flip side of strengths. I mean, and it was for O'Connor too, right? Like, she recognized the things that make her able to be a gifted artist and see things in a visionary also made that's where the sin came from. Like the failures to love, the speech, you know, the mocking of people, right, could descend into just cruelty.
Right. The reason that I'm a good writer and a good observer is the flip side of that. I understand that.
And it's, again, not to excuse the sins, but it's so wonderful to see a writer who understands, first of all, understands that it's sin, right? And is actually valuing her faith and her obedience to God over the ambition in that regard, like saying, you know, I want to do this and I believe that it's God given for me to do this, but I don't want to do this as the cost of my eternal soul, because I think that matters more, you know, that I don't hurt people, right? That I love them. And I don't know. My favorite part was not the favorite. I love so much of this, but page 29, I want to read this.
That's my favorite one too.
Oh, really? Oh, good. So would you like to read it?
No, I think you should do it.
Okay. I love this. She said, I must write down that I am to be an artist. This is 1947. She was, what, 21, something like that, right? Not in the sense of aesthetic frippery, in the sense of aesthetic craftsmanship. Otherwise, I will feel my loneliness continually, like this today. The word craftsmanship takes care of the work angle and the word aesthetic, the truth angle. It will be a life struggle with no consummation. When something is finished, it cannot be possessed. Nothing can be possessed but the struggle. All our lives are consumed in possessing struggle, but only when the struggle is cherished and directed to a final consummation outside of this life is it of any value. I want to be the best artist it is possible for me to be under God. I do not want to be lonely all my life, but people only make us lonelier by reminding us of God. Dear God, please help me to be an artist. Please let it lead to you. Whoa. There's just so much wisdom in this.
Yeah.
I can't imagine having that kind of presence of mind at 21.
Like, I know.
That's unreal.
It is. I mean, the recognition that there's loneliness in the vocation because she's a prophet, right? Like a truth teller. Yeah. And truth tellers are lonely. And it's a struggle.
She says somewhere else.
Go ahead.
She says somewhere else about, what is it? Something about everyone wants the gifts, but people forget they cost something.
The cost
something.
Of it. Yes. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I think that's just it's page 28, actually, KB. They're like visions we pay.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The intellectual and artistic delights God gives us are visions, and like visions, we pay for them. And the thirst for the vision doesn't necessarily carry with it a thirst for the attendant suffering. Yeah, right. This idea that it's a costly thing that she's been given.
And it's like all the more reinforcing the idea of the artist as a prophetic figure, the prophetic corrective. The prophets are, by definition, are not going to be popular because they tell you things about yourself that you really don't want to see. That delusional framework that I was talking about earlier. And it's like she knew that. She knew she could see. And so the only defense she had, if you will, to make sure that it would serve God would be like, I'm making sure I'm telling the truth and I'm not doing this for my own benefit and the craftsmanship, you know? So that's what I feel like she's trying to do here is just to that is what she wanted, which is amazing at age 20, 21.
Yeah, it's such a sophisticated theological aesthetic to see that the craftsmanship, the skill with which you handle the piece of art is part of the sacrifice that you're making. Or
that's
part
why,
of how it becomes holy.
That's right. And that's why she hated so much the sort of romantic or modern view of the artist as this kind of genius who's creating, you know, co-creating with God. That was an abomination to her. It was about getting it right, you know, discovering the reality of the world and getting it right, not co-creating it like Asbury in The Enduring Chill. The artist prays by creating, he says. And then the priest who doesn't even know who James Joyce is like, no, he doesn't. Shut up, Asbury. You know? That's so great. It's a total slap down, you know? Anyway. Any other thoughts on the prayer journal before we have to reluctantly bring this conversation to a close?
If you haven't read it, read it. Something changed in me from reading that.
That's a good word. Well, gosh, I guess we have to call it an episode, friends. So the last segment we always do is passing on. So, what are we going to pass on? Let's start with you, Victoria.
So I'm going to recommend my favorite O'Connor story, Parker's Back. I don't even know how to summarize it. It's got weird Christian embodiment stuff. And if you're into any of the things we've been talking about tonight, you will probably be into it too. I don't really want to spoil the story either. Just read Parker's Back if you think you like O'Connor and you haven't read it yet.
Yeah, and we talked about this briefly before we got on the episode, and all three of us agree. I think we all agree that it's her best story. Did I remember that correctly? I think it's her best story.
Yeah, I agree.
And especially if you're interested in her as an artist and the artist figure who in that story is actually the tattoo artist. So, and that's not some big spoiler. That's an argument that I'm trying to make.
Yeah.
Okay. KB, what about you?
So I want to recommend the work of a friend of mine. Her name is Maria Bowler. You can find her online at mariabowler.com. Maria is, and she has a forthcoming book called Making Time, A New Vision for Crafting a Life Beyond Productivity. So Maria is a writer. She's also a coach who has so many inspiring things to say about the life of the artist in this contemporary capitalist society who sort of doesn't take the life of the spirit seriously or the life of creative people seriously beyond their output. So follow Maria, check out her website, definitely buy her new book when it comes out in, I think, January, Making Time, A New Vision for Crafting a Life Beyond Productivity.
That sounds really great. And I'm going to, you know, cheat and, you know, make two recommendations because that's what I do. I cheat. The first recommendation is keeping along with the Flannery O'Connor theme, that reading her essays and especially her letters, Ralph Wood used to always say that if you read some of her letters a little bit before bedtime, it will save your soul. And I think there's some truth to that because the letters are hilarious. They're brilliant. They're full of compassion and love for the people who wrote to her. And I just find them an absolute inspiration. And in fact, it's been a while since I've read them. So, you know, now that I have, you know, a little extra time on my hands, I might pick them up again. The next recommendation that I have is the poetry of Denise Levertov, which I've probably recommended before on this podcast. But it's because a former student of mine had just sent me a poem called For Those Whom the Gods Love Less. And I'm just going to read the end of it because it fits perfectly with what we were just discussing. So if you all indulge me. She says, each life in art goes forth to meet dragons that rise from their bloody scales in cyclic rhythm. Know and forget. Know and forget. It's not only the passion for getting it right, though it's that too. It's the way radiant epiphanies recur, recur, consuming, pristine, unrecognized, until remembrance dismays you. And then, look, some inflection of light, some wing of shadow is other, unvoiced. You can, you must proceed. And yeah. When my student sent me that, I was in tears, you know. Because there's something there for all of us to pursue the vocation that God's given us to do with the dedication and focus that Flannery O'Connor had. Well, thank you for listening to the Christian Feminist Podcast. We'd really like to hear from you if you have a topic or reading recommendation for future shows, although more on that later. Or if you just want to drop us a line, you can do so at ChristianFeministPodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on our Facebook page or at the network's Twitter handle at CHR Radio Network. And check out our show notes from this and the other episodes at the Christian Humanist blog at ChristianHumanist.org. The Christian Feminist Podcast is a member of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. And Kristen Filippik is our press liaison. For Victoria Reynolds Farmer and KB Moore, I'm Christina Bieber-Lake. Tune in when episode 200 comes on, which is a kind of a retrospective for all of us. And until then, in essentials, unity, and non-essentials, liberty, and in all things, love.